Acknowledgements. This audiobook began to take shape from a collection of blog postings for Psychology Today. In fact, it was writing in my Don't Delay blog that I discovered how much I enjoyed writing to communicate ideas outside of formal, scholarly journal articles. I discovered that instead of writing to earn in my publisher Parish Academy, I was writing to learn and learning to write in a whole new way. Given this beginning to the audiobook, I want to preface my acknowledgments by giving special thanks to Libby Ma, deputy editor of Psychology Today and author, who invited me to be part of the Psychology Today bloggers in 2008, and who has nurtured my sense of self as a writer. As well, I want to thank Hera Estroff Morano, editor-at-large of Psychology Today and author, who, like Libby, has always been encouraging and supportive. They are part of a truly wonderful team of people. Writing is not a solitary activity, even though we may struggle with concepts and the words to express these ideas in our own dark night of the soul at times. Writing is a very social act, from the inception of ideas through to revising a final manuscript. So I have quite a few people I want to thank for helping me with my writing. Of course, as my father always told me, you can delegate the activity, but not the responsibility. You can share the praise, but not the blame. This means that any of the shortcomings in my writing are my own. The things that you like best about this audiobook are most probably due to the kind input of these others who deserve my words of appreciation. As a scholar, I have drawn on a wide body of research in my writing. Yet unlike my scholarly publications, I have not cited this work in an academic fashion. So I want to give credit to some key individuals who have helped develop ideas that I have distilled in this book. In terms of the procrastination research literature specifically, my colleagues Dr. Joseph Ferrari, DePaul University, Chicago, Clary Lay, retired professor, York University, Toronto, Henry Schoenberg, retired professor, University of Groningen, the Netherlands, and Fuchsia Sirois, Bishop's University, Sherbrooke, Quebec, have provided the foundation of ideas about how best to understand procrastination. If I was not drawing on their work directly in my writing, I was speaking to some of my own research that was built on their work. I am grateful to have all of them as colleagues and friends. In addition to the procrastination research, I drew on numerous other studies that have helped me to understand the nature of self-regulation failure, how we can structure our intentions to more successfully meet our goals, as well as aspects of our personality, such as perfectionism, that can undermine our goal pursuit. Although it is not possible to list everyone, I do want to note the enormous contributions made by, respectively, Drs. Roy Baumeister and Diane Tice and their students at Florida State University, Brian Little, retired professor, Carleton University, Ottawa, Peter Gallwitzer and his students at New York University, and Gordon Flett, York University, Toronto. I have learned a great deal from each of these scholars, and their work provided a framework for both understanding self-regulatory failure and strategies to more effectively exercise self-control to break non-conscious habits and patterns of behavior. It is easy to see how these esteemed and accomplished scholars have contributed to my own thinking and research. Not so obvious, but just as important, has been the contribution of my students to my research and writing. My research is driven by my students, as research at the graduate level in particular is a means to teaching and learning. I want to thank all of my students who have participated in procrastination research with me since 1995, as part of the Procrastination Research Group, and I particularly want to identify the important contributions made by Shannon Bennett, Kelly Binder, Alan Blunt, Matthew Dan, Mohsen Hagman, Eric Heward, Jennifer Lavoie, Adam McCaffrey, Rick Morin, Brian Salmon, Matthew Shanahan, Kyle Simpson, and Rachel Thibodeau. Each of these students has taken his or her own research past the thesis requirements and into the scholarly research more formally. Moving from research results to communicable ideas for others to read is a craft unto itself. I am grateful for the help of my wife, Beth, who, as a non-psychologist, is willing to ask me to clarify my ideas or my words. It takes courage for her to persist at times, I fear, because it is easy for me to become defensive about my writing. I know her thoughtful comments always makes my thinking and writing clearer. In addition, my friend Jeannie Bacon, who is willing to test the strength of friendship by providing her expertise to the editing of my book, has made an important difference in my writing. Jeannie, a writer with both graduate work in English and professional experience in technical writing, helped me to be more coherent and consistent with my prose. Where you still might find problems with my writing are places where I failed to heed her helpful advice. The comics in the written book, which provide a different perspective on the concepts discussed, as well as a little laughter at our all-too-human tendency to put it off until tomorrow, are due to the talents of my friend Paul Mason. I met Paul when he was a boy, and I was living one of my other lives as a canoe outfitter for Trailhead in Ottawa. Along with his father Bill and his sister Becky, Paul has developed an international reputation for canoeing and art. I was delighted when he agreed to collaborate with me on a comic series. When a particular comic makes you laugh, you can be sure it was Paul's creative insight that captured the concept so well. Each of the people I have identified, plus many others whom I hope I have not offended by omitting them in my words of thanks, have made readily apparent contributions to my research and writing. My final word of thanks are to those whose contributions are more obscure in terms of the writing of this audiobook, yet deeply important to me personally. They make life joyful, provide room for my writing, and bring balance to my life. My children, Laurel and Alex, along with my wonderful wife, Beth, bring love and laughter to my life. I work hard not to procrastinate on the more mundane tasks in my day, simply to be sure that there is time for them. My dog team keeps me firmly grounded and in the great outdoors enough to keep me healthy and happy. Finally, my father, Walter Pitchell, is never far from my thoughts, and I draw on his wisdom, love, and support to build a life. Ironically, one of my dad's most often used expressions is, "We'll see what happens," as he waits another day to act. I usually laugh and say to him, "No wonder I study procrastination." Yet within his words is a great deal of wisdom. Sometimes delay may truly be wise and the best course of action. Knowing the difference between procrastination and other forms of delay is a very good place to start. You'll find some of the reasons why, beginning in Chapter 1.
Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable life-changing audio programs.
Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, a concise guide to strategies for positive change. Written and read by Timothy A. Pitchell. I have dedicated this book to sabbatical. Sabbatical is a wonderful part of the academic life. It is a tradition where on every seventh year, scholars are given time, uninterrupted by teaching and administrative duties, to read, research, and write. I give thanks for this gift of scholarship, and I dedicate my writing to those at my university and faculty association who preserve this important tradition. Introduction. If you're listening to this, it's probably because you are bothered by procrastination. You may even be listening to this because you are procrastinating right now. You are avoiding some other task. I want to make the time you spend off task right now worthwhile. That is the purpose of my writing. An hour from now, you will be prepared to act differently. You will be prepared to be more successful in your goal pursuit. Are you ready to get started? That is one of my most basic strategies. Just get started. In this audiobook, I explain why this works and summarize the research evidence for such a simple, practical strategy. About this audio program. This is a short audiobook, practical and no nonsense. Although as short as possible, each concept, topic, and issue presented has been carefully researched. I have been researching and writing about procrastination for nearly 20 years. You can learn about my research at procrastination.ca. This website provides access to my research group and academic publications, as well as my I Procrastinate podcast and Don't Delay blog for Psychology Today. I have had millions of downloads of my podcasts and blog entries. Like this audiobook, these resources are research-based but meant to be very accessible for people who do not normally read or listen to psychological research. The key difference between my blog or podcast and this audiobook is the organization of the ideas. The blog and podcast cover a wide variety of important topics, but you would have to spend days reading or listening to get it all. The value of this audiobook is that it is a digest of my research, and most important, this audiobook provides a concise summary of key strategies to reduce procrastination in your life. Why is this audiobook so short? Too often, we start an audiobook, listen to the first chapter or two, and never pick it up again, although we intend to finish it. Among procrastinators, this is a terrible risk. In fact, procrastination is defined by this intention-action gap. I do not want to contribute to this, so I have written a short audiobook. Most important, I have written a short audio program because I believe that less is more. It is quite possible for me to write hundreds of pages about this topic. I have in my blog and research, for example. My graduate students regularly write lengthy theses on the topic. However, when it comes to learning strategies for change, a few key ideas are what is required. Working with these ideas in your own life will make a difference. Your reading can make a difference in your life right now, if you want it to. If you want it to. This idea is very important to understand. No technique on its own will ever work without a firm commitment to a goal. If you are committed to change, I know that what you will learn here will make a difference. I have received emails from people from all walks of life. For example, lawyers, students, homemakers, consultants, medical researchers, and even other academics, and from all over the world, that attest to the difference that these strategies are making in their lives. How the audiobook is organized. I have structured each chapter in a similar way so that the audiobook is easier and quicker to listen to. You know what to expect in each chapter. First, I begin each chapter with a key phrase that may become your mantra for change. A mantra is an often repeated expression or idea. It is commonly associated with meditation as the focus of your thoughts. I think the first sentence of every chapter can serve you best as a daily focus as you work toward change in your life. When you listen to a chapter that really speaks to you in terms of your own procrastination, memorize the opening mantra for change. Post it on your fridge or on your computer as a screensaver. In short, make it your own and reflect on it often. Second, I offer an example through a short story that highlights a common problem with procrastination. These stories are based on lived experiences shared with me by research participants as replies to my blog postings and podcasts, as well as through people I have met at invited talks, workshops, and even at social gatherings. These are people who tell me that they would be the perfect subject for my studies. I hope these stories help situate the issue in lived experience for you. Third, I summarize the key issues illustrated in the story. Here, I draw on research, but I do not quote dates, names, or other details as I do in my academic papers, blog, or podcasts. I write about the issue and research in simple terms to keep the concepts clear. When I do introduce a term from research, some psychological jargon, I explain what it means. Fourth, based on the research, I present strategies that you might use to facilitate change in your life. These strategies flesh out the mantra at the beginning of the chapter, linking the issue and what we know from research to things you can do to reduce your procrastination. These strategies are the practical things that you can do to solve the procrastination puzzle in your own life. As appropriate, I also provide a place for you to rephrase the key ideas in relation to your own life. This is where you make the concepts your own in the context of your own life. This is where you do your first bit of personal work and goal setting. Finally, in the written book, you would find at least one comic in each chapter. Paul Mason, an artist, creative genius, and all-around great guy, and I created this series of comics together. In the comics, we embrace the notion of carpe diem. The Latin expression carpe diem, which means literally seize the day, has been used for centuries with contrasting meanings. For example, it has been used to celebrate and defend procrastination with a focus on enjoying the moment. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. And it has also been used as an admonition, scolding ourselves to focus on the pressing task at hand with expressions such as, make hay while the sun shines. Our comic allows us to laugh at our propensity to put it off while lamenting the tragedy of our inability to seize the day and accomplish our goals. Laugh or cry, we hope you'll enjoy the situations we portray. Although the context for these comics is college and university life, I think you will find the themes applicable to other life domains. Okay, enough by way of introduction. Let's just get started. What is procrastination? Chapter 1. What is procrastination? Why does it matter? All procrastination is delay, but not all delay is procrastination. Maria, a working mother of three young children, reaches the end of her day with lots left to do. Again, she didn't get the laundry put away or her files sorted in her office. She beats herself up, calling herself a procrastinator, yet she's confused about how she'll ever be able to get it all done when so much happens each day that's out of her control. She plans carefully, but the kids' illness, changes at the daycare, and both her and her husband's travel for work always seem to necessitate change in her plans and delays on some tasks. Issue. These examples in Maria's life should not be seen as procrastination. We all have to delay things. Delay is part of making priorities. Of course, a child's illness takes precedence over much of what we might plan that day. Other tasks need to be delayed to make time for doctor's appointments, home care, whatever is necessary. The key issue here is that it is not a voluntary delay in the strictest sense. Procrastination is the voluntary delay of an intended action, despite the knowledge that this delay may harm the individual in terms of the task performance or even just how the individual feels about the task or him or herself. Procrastination is a needless, voluntary delay. In Maria's case, the delay on putting away the laundry and filing were not truly voluntary. She was not needlessly taking on some alternative task to avoid the laundry or filing. She was optimizing her use of time to meet one of her most important life goals, to be the best mother she can. There are many types of delay in our lives. I believe we need to learn to appreciate this. Some delays are not only necessary, as with the example of Maria's task delay in favor of her children's health, they are wise. We might also decide to delay an action on a project because we need more information first. It is wise to put things off at times rather than to act impulsively or hastily. Delay is a necessary part of our lives. At any given moment, there are a number of things we could do. What will we choose to do? This choice is based partly on our earlier intentions, our plans for the day, But of course, our choice will also depend on the context of the moment. What is happening right now that has an effect on our choices? What is most important now? What is the wisest thing we can do given our goals, responsibilities, roles, and desires? Procrastination, in contrast to other forms of delay, is that voluntary and quite deliberate turning away from an intended action, even when we know we could act on our intention right now. There is nothing preventing us from acting in a timely manner, except our own reluctance to act. This is the puzzling aspect of procrastination. Why are we reluctant to act? Why is it we become our own worst enemy? We undermine our own goal pursuit needlessly. Why? How can we solve this procrastination puzzle? To understand the procrastination puzzle, that voluntary but needless delay in our lives that undermines our goal pursuit, we need to understand this reluctance to act when it's in our best interest to act. We also need to have strategies to overcome this reluctance. The conscious use of strategies to overcome our reluctance to act is essential because procrastination for many people is a habit. That is, procrastination is a habitual response to tasks or situations, and like all habits, it's an internalized, non-conscious process. It is what we do without really thinking about it. In fact, cross-cultural research by Joseph Ferrari at DePaul University, Chicago, has demonstrated that for as much as 20% of the population, this procrastination habit is quite chronic and affects many parts of our lives. Habits are not easy to change. We need to make conscious effort with specific strategies for change to be successful. Throughout this audiobook, I argue that we need to make pre-decisions to act in a different way, counter to the habitual response. Based largely on the work of Peter Gollwitzer, New York University, I emphasize many different ways that we can use pre-decisions to act when we intend to act, to reduce the effects of potential distractions, and to cope more effectively with setbacks and disappointments as we work toward changing our behavior. In the chapters that follow, I explain why we may be reluctant to act on our intentions. Then I offer strategies for change to help develop more effective self-regulation by breaking habitual ways of responding. The purpose of this introductory chapter is to emphasize that not all delay is procrastination, and the importance of focusing on the needless delay that is undermining us. Strategies for change. My initial strategy for change is for you to begin to categorize in your own mind which delays in your life are procrastination. These are the delays that you want to do something about. Knowing this difference is a good place to start. As you begin to identify which delays are truly voluntary delays that undermine your performance and well-being, you may see a pattern emerge. These tasks, projects, or intended actions may have something in common. For example, you may find that these tasks, projects, or intended actions elicit common feelings. On a separate piece of paper, or on your computer, or simply as a thought experiment, list those tasks, project activities, or things in your life on which you tend to procrastinate. Next to each, jot down what emotions and thoughts come to mind when you think of each of these moments of procrastination. Do not overthink this. It could be, for example, that you're uncertain about what to do to complete a task. When you have finished your list, look for patterns in the emotions or thoughts involved. You will want to refer back to these while listening to some of the chapters that follow. Chapter 2. Is procrastination really a problem? What are the costs of procrastinating? Procrastination is failing to get on with life itself. I attended a conference a few summers ago titled Living Well and Dying Well, New Frontiers of Positive Psychology, Therapy, and Spiritual Care. During a discussion of coping with death and counseling individuals who are grieving, One of the psychologists in attendance noted two kinds of regrets that people express in their grief over the loss of a loved one: regrets of commission and omission. The second regret, the things we omitted doing while our loved one was alive, captured my interest. Regrets of omission are so often the result of procrastination. I asked this psychologist, what is the nature of these regrets of omission, adding, are these, one, things people really intended to do but never did, meaning procrastination, two, generalized possibilities of what they could have done, three, cultural scripts of what they think they should have done, would have been nice to do, four, internalized expectations of what the loved one might have wanted them to do. The psychologist replied that all four types were part of the regrets he had seen in his practice. So I pushed on a little further and asked which type of regret seemed most problematic. As I expected, given the guilt associated with procrastination, regret over the things that these grieving people really intended to do but did not was most problematic. The regrets of omission related to our procrastination were most troubling in the grieving process. Issue. Everyone procrastinates. I believe this, and research has documented this in a number of different ways. In fact, I think that people who say that they have never procrastinated might also say that they have never told a lie or been rude to someone. It is possible, I guess, but unlikely. We certainly do not like to admit to these undesirable actions. So if everyone procrastinates, why is it a problem? The research evidence is clear. People who score high on self-report measures of procrastination also self-report lower achievement overall, more negative feelings, and even significantly more health problems. Let me discuss each of these briefly. The lower achievement is easy to explain. Although we can all remember instances when we procrastinated and did very well, we cherish these memories to make us feel better and to justify even more procrastination. On the whole, procrastination results in less time to do a thorough job. This usually means poorer work overall. A meta-analysis of the procrastination research conducted by Pierce Steele, University of Calgary, has shown that procrastination is certainly never helpful and usually harmful to our task performance. The fact that procrastination is associated with more negative emotions or moods is puzzling. If we are procrastinating, you would think we'd actually feel better because we're not doing the tasks we do not want to do in favor of the things we enjoy. At least, that is what you would think we are doing. The thing is, our research shows that even when we are procrastinating, and I mean when we're actually off task and researchers ask us questions then about our feelings, we do not report feeling happier necessarily. There is a mixture of feelings experienced, including guilt. So on the whole, procrastination does not make us feel that great, and this is particularly true in the long run. Finally, the new research by Fuchsia Sirwa, Bishop's University, Sherbrooke, Quebec, that demonstrates that procrastination actually compromises our health is very interesting. Procrastination seems to affect health in two ways. First, procrastination causes stress, which is not a good thing for our health for many reasons. For example, stress compromises our immune systems. Second, chronic procrastinators needlessly delay health behaviors, such as exercising, eating healthfully, and getting enough sleep. This affects our health negatively, particularly over time. Sure, not exercising today or not eating vegetables today is not going to harm us today, but you know how it goes. Tomorrow is the same situation. We rationalize one more day of delay, and before we know it, it has been years of neglected, that is, procrastinated, health behaviors. The results can be devastating, with increased risk for heart disease, diabetes, and other debilitating illnesses that can be prevented with more daily attention to simple but avoided health behaviors. The day-to-day delay on small but cumulatively important tasks affects us in other ways as well. A good example is retirement savings. It's easy to put off saving to another day, but this procrastination costs us in the long run. All of this is true about procrastination. It is seldom helpful, but we can certainly recall when it is, and it is usually harmful to our task performance, psychological well-being, and even our physical health. Although all of these outcomes are negative, this is not what might concern us most about the consequence of procrastination. Procrastination is a problem with not getting on with life itself. When we procrastinate on our goals, we are our own worst enemy. These are our goals, our tasks, and we are needlessly putting them off. Our goals are the things that make up a good portion of our lives. In fact, both philosophers and psychologists have proposed that happiness is found in the pursuit of our goals. It is not necessarily that we are accomplishing anything in particular, but that we are engaged in the pursuit of what we think is meaningful in our lives. When we procrastinate on our goals, we are basically putting off our lives. We are certainly wasting the time we could be using toward our goal pursuit. The thing is, the most finite, limited resource in our lives is time. We only have a finite amount of time to live. Why waste it? Why waste it running away from tasks that we want or need to do? Let's return for a moment to the story I told at the beginning of this chapter. As I listened to psychologists present their research papers and therapists talk about the grieving process, I left each session more convinced of the importance of dealing with procrastination as a symptom of an existential malaise, a malaise that can only be addressed by our deep commitment to authoring the stories of our lives. To author our own lives, we have to be an active agent in our lives, not a passive participant making excuses for what we are not doing. When we learn to stop needless, voluntary delay in our lives, we live more fully. It is time to make a commitment to engaging in your life, achieving your goals, and enjoying the journey. Time is too precious to waste. Strategy for change. One of the most important preconditions for successful change is a deep commitment to that change. You really have to value that change. So I want to focus your attention on the cost of your procrastination to enhance your goal commitment. Take a moment now to think about the list of tasks that you came up with after listening to Chapter 1. Recall that these were the tasks, goals, projects on which you are procrastinating. You may want to add new ones, too, after listening to this chapter and thinking further about procrastination. Next to each of these tasks or goals, note how your procrastination has affected you in terms of such things as your happiness, stress, health, finances, relationships, and so on. You may even want to discuss this with a confidant or a significant other in your life who knows you well. In fact, you may be surprised by what they may have to say about the cost of procrastination in your life. Like tobacco smoke, there are secondhand effects of procrastination of which you may be unaware, including broken promises, unfulfilled obligations, and the added burden to others of picking up the pieces while you are busy with your last-minute efforts. Again. In short, it is important to recognize and acknowledge all of the costs associated with the self-regulation failure we commonly call procrastination. This knowledge can be helpful in maintaining your commitment to change. What I expect you will see in this list is how much you are paying for your procrastination. The reward of following through with your listening today is to learn how to eliminate these unnecessary costs in your life. Strengthening goal intentions. It is one thing to know the cost of not acting. It is quite another to have a strong commitment to the goal itself. A strong goal intention, an intention for which you have a very strong commitment, is absolutely essential. As is commonly said, where there's a will, there's a way. To strengthen a goal intention, it's important to recognize the benefits of acting now, not just the costs of needless delay. Taking time to think about how your goals align with your values and larger, longer-term life goals, or simply the short-term benefit of getting a necessary task done, can be an important step in strengthening goal intentions. In a list of the goals and projects that you've made, add notes about why this goal or task is important to get done, as well as the benefits of acting now as opposed to later. Finally, knowing something is different from realizing it, making it real in our lives. For example, we can understand that health habits, such as regular exercise or eating low-fat foods and less refined sugar, are good for us. However, we can fail to act on this knowledge until something makes this information real in our lives. A common example of this is the strengthening of goal intentions for health behaviors following the diagnosis of a serious illness, such as a cardiovascular disease. With the diagnosis, the knowledge of the link between behavior and health outcomes becomes real in our lives, not just knowledge about the world in general. The trouble is, it can be too late to act at this point, and waiting for an epiphany of this sort is not the most effective life strategy. It is very important to regularly examine our intentions as a starting point to reduce procrastination. To the extent that we can strengthen our goal intentions, we are much more likely to act in a timely manner. Chapter 3. What's the most important thing we need to know about procrastination? I won't give in to feel good. Feeling good now comes at a cost. Martin said that he would work on the report this morning. That was yesterday, and he felt good to put that awful task off until tomorrow. Now he is facing the task, and he feels awful. He is anxious and frustrated. He really dislikes this report. Feeling a whole range of negative emotions, he decides to work on some other less important stuff instead. His mood lifts as he pushes the report aside for another day. Issue. As the work of Roy Baumeister and Diane Tice, Florida State University, has clearly shown, procrastination is a form of self-regulation failure. We fail to regulate our behavior to achieve our own goals. We make an intention to act, but we do not use the self-control necessary to act when intended. This is the voluntary nature of the delay that I stressed in the first chapter that characterizes procrastination. We may voluntarily delay our action because we are unable or unwilling to self-regulate our behavior to act now. There are many types of self-regulation problems, including problem gambling, overeating, reckless spending, and drinking too much. Procrastination is best understood as a problem like these, a problem with our self-regulation. Why do we fail to self-regulate? Although there are many factors that contribute to this, the most important thing to understand is that we give in to feel good. That is, we want to feel good now and will do whatever it takes for immediate mood repair, usually at the expense of long-term goals. When we give in to feel good, we give in to impulsive urges. These urges can take many forms. We might gamble, shop, or eat more than we need, ingest mood-altering substances, or procrastinate, all in an effort to avoid negative emotions. Of course, my focus is on how we use procrastination, needless task delay, to give in to feel good. When facing a task we intend to do but do not want to, we feel a number of possible negative emotions. We may feel frustrated, angry, bored, resentful, depressed, anxious, or guilty. These emotions may be some of the emotions that you listed in your table at the end of listening to Chapter 1. Generally, we call this task aversiveness. Aversive tasks are things that we all want to put off. They make us feel bad. We do not like doing these tasks. Who really wants to do an aversive task? No one. However, the task may be necessary for us to reach a desired goal. We may not want to do the task, but we need to do it. The key issue is that for chronic procrastinators, short-term mood repair takes precedence. Chronic procrastinators want to eliminate the negative mood or emotions now, so they give in to feel good. They give in to the impulse to put off the task until another time. Now, not faced with the task, they feel better. If you find that you're chronically procrastinating, it may well be that you are running away from negative feelings by putting off your tasks. Of course, this is temporarily rewarding. The moment we put off the task until tomorrow, we feel relief from the negative emotions. And, as you may have learned in a basic psychology course, behaviors that are rewarded get repeated. We are reinforcing our procrastination, and it becomes a problem. Strategies for change. The issue of short-term mood repair in favor of long-term goal pursuit is a crucial one when it comes to addressing our procrastination. It is important to recognize that giving in to feel good is at the heart of self-regulation failure, and it's important to develop strategies for change. I want to begin with the most basic and perhaps least palatable strategy that I can think of in relation to giving in to feel good. That is, when faced with a task where our natural inclination is to say, "I'll do this later," or "I'll feel more like this tomorrow," we need to stop and recognize that we are saying this in order to avoid the negative emotions we are feeling right now. Knowledge is power in this regard. First and foremost, we need to recognize that this task makes us feel awful, and what we're trying to do is run away from these feelings. Of course, this takes a certain amount of emotional intelligence. This type of intelligence is not related to the size of our vocabulary or the ability to do arithmetic. Emotional intelligence is the ability to effectively identify and utilize emotions to guide behavior. Recent research has shown that lower emotional intelligence is related to more procrastination. But the good news is that we can increase our emotional intelligence. We can learn to more effectively perceive, understand, and regulate our emotions. This is very important in terms of more effective self-control. In any case, based on what I know about procrastination, it seems clear that most people who procrastinate are emotionally aware enough to recognize that some tasks make them feel awful and that they are procrastinating to escape these emotions. What may require further focus and strengthening is the ability to regulate emotions, or at least some commitment not to take the path of least resistance, that is, not to give in to feel good. What we really need to do is to come to terms with our negative feelings about a task. We need to find a way to cope with these negative feelings so that we can continue to pursue our intended goal. The question is, how? While I was writing this book, Ivy, a podcast listener, wrote to me to say that she had developed some of her own mantras related to the I Procrastinate podcasts. Here's what she developed on this topic. Don't give in to feel good. Step on up to what should. I like this type of mantra or slogan, as you know. It can help us focus more on changing our procrastination habit. Ivy's mantra could easily replace the one I offered at the beginning of this chapter. This tough strategy is immediately effective as a first step. We have to suck it up, as they say. Yes, we are feeling awful about the task at hand. We would rather run away, give in to feel good. However, the first step at the moment of procrastination is to stay put. If you turn away in an effort to make yourself feel better, it's over. Certainly, staying put in dealing with these initial negative emotions is not the whole solution, but it's an absolutely necessary first step. The key to success with this emotional experience is to be prepared. I will explain just why I'm urging you to prepare in a certain way later. For now, I just want you to think about the following as your first step in an anti-procrastination strategy. Think. If I feel negative emotions when I face a task at hand, then I will stay put and not stop, put off a task, or run away. This if-then format of an intention has been labeled an implementation intention by Peter Galwitzer of New York University. I will have more to say about implementation intentions in a later chapter. At the moment, the key thing is that you need to internalize this implementation intention in order to take a first step related to the negative emotions that are associated with procrastination. Although I think most of us have to recognize that we might very well have to just experience the first moments of these negative emotions, we do not simply have to take a tough guy approach and suck it up to succeed. There is another, gentler approach we can take. Essentially, it comes down to choosing the emotions on which we will focus. For example, although the dominant emotion at the moment may be fear, we may have fear. The key thing is that we do not have to be our fear. We can acknowledge this fear, but choose to continue to pursue our goals working from some other part of ourself. Parker Palmer, one of my favorite educational writers, speaks of this as working from some other part of our inner landscape. Our inner landscape, the psychology of self, is more than the fear we may be experiencing. It also includes our curiosity, our desire to succeed, and another very strong emotion, our interest. If we choose to acknowledge our fear, but find the courage to be, in spite of this fear, to work from another part of our inner landscape, we may more successfully stay put and stay on task. We will not give in to feel good. We will have made the first step toward beating procrastination. Of course, we are quite expert at finding reasons not to persist like this. In the face of negative emotions, we might even try to justify why we want to run away. We will not acknowledge our fear or frustration. We might simply think, I'll feel more like doing this tomorrow. We probably won't. I think we all know this deep down. This is part of the strangely puzzling nature of procrastination. We have become our own worst enemy, and we even know how to lie to ourselves. Emotionally, we are giving in to feel good, while justifying this choice by thinking, I'll feel more like doing this tomorrow. No, we won't. In the next chapter, I explain why. Chapter 4. Why We Won't Feel Like It Tomorrow. I won't feel more like doing it tomorrow. To introduce this chapter, I want to share a story I received from a reader of my Psychology Today blog. It clearly illustrates the problem of tomorrow. This reader said that the issue of feeling more like it tomorrow was reminiscent of a sign in a butcher shop window in her grandparents' village in Poland. Translated into English, the sign read, "Today you pay, and tomorrow you get it for free." When the customers would come tomorrow for their free goods, the butcher would say, "Read the sign. Today you pay, tomorrow it's free." As this reader noted, it's pretty much that way with procrastination. The tomorrow, in which I'll really feel like it, is always a day away. It never becomes today. Issue. The story above captures the basic issue with procrastination. I'll do it tomorrow. In fact, the Latin roots of the word procrastination mean to put forward to tomorrow. Yet, as the butcher explained with his sign, that tomorrow never really comes. As with the butcher's sign, that implied that customers would get free goods tomorrow, our thinking plays a trick too. We think, I'll feel more like it tomorrow. What we need to understand, so as not to be tricked like the butcher's customers, is why this is not true. We will not feel more like it tomorrow. Research, particularly studies by Dan Gilbert, Harvard University, and Tim Wilson, University of Virginia, indicates that we are not very good forecasters. No, I don't mean weather forecasters. Meteorologists seem to be better at forecasting the weather, at least in the short term, than we are at forecasting our own mood in the future. Forecasting our future mood is known as affective forecasting. The main idea behind affective forecasting is that we have a bias when we predict future moods, affective states, in relation to positive or negative events. For example, a couple of years after winning a lottery, The winners were about as happy as they were before their win, despite the general affective forecast that they would be much happier if only they could win the lottery.